The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading from Reminisce Magazine. We're going to start today with Trivial Pursuits. Would you believe this quiz is all about Get Smart? Grab a shoe phone and dial up what you know about this 1965-inspired sitcom. This pair of comedy legends dreamed up the show. Do you know who they are? It's Mel Brooks and Buck Henry. According to its creators, Get Smart pays homage to these two Hollywood spies. Who are the spies? James Bond and Inspector Clouseau. He stars as the bumbling Maxwell Smart, codename Agent 86, and she is the brainy but unnamed Agent 99. Do you know who these actor and actress were? Don Adams and Barbara Feldon. The agents work for this counter-espionage agency based in Washington, D.C. Do you remember the name? Control. This is the evil spy network trying to take over the world. Do you remember its name? Kaus. Dick Gautier plays this robot who was the best man at the wedding of Max and 99. Do you remember the name of the robot? Jaime. This contraption for sharing top secret information rarely works, much to the chief's frustration. Do you know what it's called? The Cone of Silence. Agent 86 has ties to another agent, K-13, from his spy school graduating class. Who is it? His dog, Fang. And the last question. Max walks through how many doors in the show's opening? He walks through 7 doors. For the Our Heroes section, James Farkas of Northfield, Michigan, submits an article entitled Detachment Cartoonist. After saying my goodbyes in Detroit in February 1957, I boarded a plane bound for Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. I had 6 weeks of basic training before I would be sent to Air Traffic Control School at Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi. The training was physically and mentally demanding, and recruits all tried to avoid getting extra duties such as scrubbing the barrack floors with a toothbrush, which I had to do, or cleaning the tin latrines. During rare moments of downtime, I liked to sketch. In high school, I'd gotten pretty good at drawing cartoons and caricatures of the people I observed. At the end of one exhausting day of exercises and drills, I was relaxing in the barracks. I was making a sketch of one of our drill instructors barking orders and calling us unmentionable names. The other recruits gathered around and were laughing at my cartoon when the drill instructor walked in and demanded to know what the ruckus was about. Fearing for my life, or at least the fate of cleaning latrines for a week, I showed him the caricature. Silence. "Is that supposed to be me?" he asked. Then, to my amazement, he laughed and asked if he could have the drawing. After that, word of my sketches got around, and soon the other drill instructors were excusing me from daily regimes so I could fulfill their drawing request. In fact, an hour before I graduated as an airman third class, I was putting the finishing touches on my final caricature. I gave away all of the drawings I made in boot camp, and it sure would be fun to see one of them now. From the Family Tree section, I have an article submitted by Caroline Bada of Rio Rancho, New Mexico, and it's titled Escape from the Iron Curtain. My father, Joseph Bada, was born in 1938 in Ballantyn-Fürd, Hungary, which the Nazi army entered a few years later. After the war, the occupying Russians deemed his father, a local butcher, to be a capitalist and confiscated his property and businesses. My father, then 18, his cousin Laszlo, and friend Lacey, along with many other students, demonstrated against the communist regime. On October 23, 1956, the Soviet military intervened, killing many revolutionaries. Warned of coming arrest and knowing the fate of prisoners, Dad and six others hired a truck driver to take them to the Austrian border. At the meeting point with the driver, Dad, Laszlo, and Lacey saw their friends being arrested. They hid and then took a commuter train, finally making it to within a few hundred yards of the mined and electrified border. There they met hundreds of fellow citizens trying to cross. Hungarian guards drew weapons, questioning them, but then wished them well and stood aside. Crawling between railroad tracks, they crossed the border into Austria at 4 a.m. on November 21st. Near the end of the following May, Dad made it to the U.S. The Presbyterian Church arranged a sponsor, and Dad and Laszlo landed in Newcastle, Indiana. Lacey ultimately settled in Germany. Dad never stopped loving his home country of Hungary, but he always reminds my brother and me how lucky we are to have grown up here. And to complement this article, I have another article titled Crawling to Freedom. The Hungarian crisis that Caroline's father witnessed led to the displacement of nearly 250,000 people who fled the country after thousands were killed. Sponsors or immigrant aid societies brought refugees such as Joseph and Laszlo out of peril to resettle in new countries. Hungary was not the only country to experience such atrocities. Our ancestors left their homelands for many reasons. In your research, it is vital to look at the push and pull in your ancestors' lives that would cause them to seek a brighter future. It takes immense courage to face the unknown. Learn about wars and conflicts, climate and weather disasters, and political issues through sites such as these. Britannica.com, en.wikipedia.org, and FamilySearch.org. Today's featured articles are from a section titled Dear Diary, Pages from My Teenage Years. And the first article is submitted by Gail Hefner of Pataskala, Ohio, and it's titled Swing Out Sister. In 1959, most of the girls in my fourth grade class had diaries. Writing down your secret special thoughts seemed wonderful to me. My brother Gary was adept at teasing me, and my sister Gwen and I shared a bedroom. It was hard to keep anything away from her. Nail polish often disappeared from on top of my dresser and magically appeared on top of hers. I wrote sporadically in my diary over a span of 5 years, from 1960 to 64. I know of only one time when my sister found the key and read my diary. Our mom had to act as referee to get me on speaking terms with Gwen again. December 25th, 1959. I got a watch from Grandpa and Grandma Hefner, a beautiful Hamilton wristwatch. Grandma made me learn to tell time perfectly before she would get me a watch. I also got this lovely pink ponytail diary from Gary and a jewelry kit from Gwen. I was so excited to get the diary. March 17, 1962. I went to my first dance. It was a St. Patrick's Day dance at Carroll Elementary in Lithopolis. The first dance the boy I danced with was a total stranger. I went to the dance with Bonnie, who goes to that school. During the evening, Chuck asked me for two square dances. I was so startled and shy that I said no both times. Oh boy, that was crazy. Note, this is the entry that Gwen read. She wrote me a note on the bottom of the page. If I were you, I would have said yes. He likes you. Charlie went on to serve in Vietnam and earned several medals, including a Purple Heart in 1968. In 2014, he was inducted into the Ohio Military Hall of Fame. December 3, 1962. In gym class today, I got to dance with Harry. Finally. When it came time to swing your partner, he did it so tenderly, and the way he smiled at me, ooh la la. Carol Fisher said when he slapped hands with her, he did it really hard, but when he slapped hands with me, he did it real gentle. I really like him. And for the next diary article, Phyllis Wilson of Massillon, Ohio, submits one titled Future Prospect. When I was 10, the diary of Anne Frank had such a profound effect on me that I decided to keep a diary myself. My teen entries were filled with co-ed dances, secret crushes, and wishing I was in the in crowd. One entry from when I was 16 stands out. I was working part-time at W.T. Grant's department store during the Christmas holidays. A cute guy and two of his friends came in, and the cute one kept wandering back to where I was working to talk with me. Before he left, he asked for my phone number. After he was gone, I told my best friend, who also worked there, that I had just met the boy I was going to marry. 4 years and 1 month later, Bob and I did get married. In January, we celebrated our 50th anniversary. To the best of my knowledge, my mom never read my diary, but a few years ago, I asked my brothers if they ever peeked at it. They laughed and said they had tried a few times, but my writing was so bad, they couldn't read it. And the final article from the diary section is titled, Not a Day Goes By, and it's submitted by Glenn Bridges of Duncan, South Carolina. For my 8th birthday, my parents gave me a 5-year diary. Little did I know how much it would mean to me. My very first entry was short and simple. February 25, 1969. Today is my birthday. I got a 5-year diary, a pen, a tape recorder. We had cake and ice cream. At the time, I wasn't committed to writing every day, so it turned into a 6-year diary. I treasure it, especially reading what I got for my next 4 birthdays and Christmases, including the BB gun Santa brought me in 1971. I was also obsessed with detailing what Mom fixed for dinner each night, such as green beans, ham, and cornbread. As an intern at a local newspaper in my junior year of college, I had to maintain a daily log of the stories I wrote, photos I took, places I visited, people I met, sources I quoted, and so forth. After graduating, I was so mesmerized reading my 2-year chronicle that I decided to continue the habit. I've kept a daily record now for 38 years. Over time, my journals became larger and thicker, packed with ticket stubs and other small mementos. I've recorded the births of my children, grandchildren, nieces, and nephews, the passing of loved ones, vacations and foreign travel, places I've lived, cars I've owned. Family members often ask me to verify details or events. When was the last time we had sunny weather on the 4th of July? What year did we go to San Diego? I've learned that you make notations in pen, not pencil, if you want them to last. With every new journal I start, I write the motto, "It's hard to be nostalgic when you can't remember anything." I intend to keep this up, draining ink by the gallon until I can no longer write. The next article I want to share with you is about the Empire State Building, and it's written by Natalie Wysong. Above it all, skyscrapers transformed New York in the early 20th century, with each new entry bidding to stand tallest in its dynamic skyline. Wall Street's 1929 crash disrupted the construction frenzy, but as the Great Depression spread, the building named for the Empire State grew floor by floor, becoming the tallest in a forest of towers. Two factions of the Astor family owned neighboring mansions on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. In the 1890s, the two houses were pulled down and hotels went up instead. Connected, they formed the Waldorf Astoria, the social seat of the Gilded Age. As commerce increased in the area and taste changed, the hotel fell out of fashion. The land was sold and the Waldorf Astoria was demolished, its elegant fittings auctioned and scrapped. In its place, an investor group spearheaded by financier John J. Raskob made plans to erect a contestant in the city's procession of skyscrapers. Raskob's investor group backed what was to be the world's first 100-story-plus office tower, signing on with an architectural firm just weeks before the stock market crash of 1929. It took architect William F. Lamb only 2 weeks to produce the drawings for the modernistic building with a slender, pointed silhouette. John J. Raskob was a General Motors executive and dealmaker. He chose his friend Al Smith, a former four-term governor of New York, to be the face of the entire state project. The popular Smith proved an ideal choice, promoting the venture to allies and cheerleading the drive to build as high as possible. Construction on the Empire State Colossus began March 17, 1930. With unemployment climbing as the Great Depression took hold, workers were plentiful. To speed up the process in the congested Fifth Avenue construction zone, railway tracks were put in, running to the elevator in the basement and on some floors. Water taps throughout the building and cafes set up on unfinished floors saved workers trips down to street level. The building went up at a record pace of 4 stories per week. It only took 6 months to complete the steel skeleton, and on September 9th, Al Smith, a member of the Bricklayers Union, laid the cornerstone. On May 1, 1931, from Washington, D.C., President Herbert Hoover pushed a button to signal the building's official opening. The claim that the tower on the Empire State Building would serve as a dirigible docking station was likely never more than a publicity stunt. The buffeting winds that race up the sides of the tower make docking a blimp or any aircraft impractical and dangerous. The project was complete in 1 year and 45 days, and investors had 2 million-plus square feet of office space on their hands. New York City's rentable office space had multiplied during the building boom of the 1920s, and now as the economy languished and unemployment rose, the gigantic investment faced huge risk, earning it the nickname the Empty State Building. Renters were scarce, but New Yorkers and tourists loved the building, paying admission to visit the observatory deck, even during the height of the Depression. And in 1933, the spectacle of King Kong scaling the building was an immediate hit with audiences, fixing the building as a symbol, a great city's greatest achievement. The entire state building wasn't profitable for years, not until 1950, in fact. But even in the late 1930s, the $1 admission fee to the observatory deck on the 86th floor was bringing in $1 million per year. The building remained the tallest in the world for 40 years until it was surpassed by the towers of the World Trade Center, which were completed in 1971. By then, the Empire State Building status was secure. For celebrities and tourists alike, no trip to the Big Apple was complete without a visit to the iconic landmark, and it still attracts more than 4 million visitors annually. When President Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected in November 1932, a beacon shone at the Empire State Building, the start of a tradition of using illumination to celebrate special events. Colored floodlights were added in 1976, bathing the building in patriotic colors to honor America's bicentennial. In 2012, an LED system, which can display 16 million colors, replaced the floodlights. In recent years, a $550 million overhaul increased the historic landmark's energy efficiency. Innovations such as dimming system that adjusts the brightness inside the building based on the light coming in through the 6,514 retrofitted windows have reduced the building's carbon footprint. After a 5-year renovation, a new observatory opened in 2019. Visitors go to the top floor, the 102nd, where if the day is clear, the floor-to-ceiling windows provide a view into 6 states. A new second-floor museum has exhibits about the building's place in pop culture and its history, such as its ties to the lost Waldorf Astoria. The Empire State Building may no longer be the tallest building in the New York City skyline, but the unmistakable landmark, its silhouette visible from miles around, still signifies the heart of the metropolis. The landmark Empire State Building has appeared in more than 250 movies, cast as strong and silent in a range of genres. Here are some of the movies that have been filmed at the Empire State Building. For romance movies, we have Love Affair, An Affair to Remember, and Sleepless in Seattle. And for a thriller, the movie King Kong was filmed there, as well as Superman II and Independence Day. The musical On the Town and the comedy The Producers were also filmed at the Empire State Building. Maureen King Cassidy of Oyster Bay, New York, submits an article for the Last Laugh section titled, She Saw Red and Lost It. My husband and I moved from the New York City metro area in the 1980s to Pennsylvania, a location that was quieter and more affordable. While in New York, I'd worked as a local radio news reporter. That experience helped me land a job as a TV news anchor in a semi-rural area of my new state. One night, when my co-anchor and I were delivering the evening news on air, I had to read a story about a local resident who had grown a very large tomato. As I read the teleprompter on live TV, I was struck unexpectedly by the humor of an oversized vegetable being newsworthy enough to make it on local TV. Of course, it would never happen in New York. When the featured tomato loomed up on the screen like a gigantic blood moon, I started laughing. Things only got worse as the segment continued, with a reporter at the scene interviewing the grower, treating the story with due sincerity in an area of the country where gardening is serious business. How long did it take to grow it this big? The reporter asked. Did you use any special methods to achieve that? My laughing was beyond control at this point. I barely got through the rest of the segment. But the story and its peculiarities didn't stop there. The night after our news piece aired, someone stole the giant tomato from the woman's yard. Then, in an even stranger twist, the prize vegetable was returned the next day. I learned in the follow-up that the gardener was not happy after she saw the footage of me laughing at her unusual accomplishment. It wasn't one of my finer moments as a broadcaster, but it's a news story I will never forget. From the Lasting Impression section, Rebecca Spohn of Auburn, Michigan, submitted an article titled A Home for Book Lovers. Among the pages of my photo album are many snapshots of my parents, Harvey and Audrey Hirsch, smiling and full of life. Thankfully, the sadness of missing them is quickly replaced with pride that the work of art they created together live on. Dad told me and my three sisters stories of growing up in the 1930s with a single mom who was too poor to buy him a book. He desperately wanted to read, and his longing for books explained why our childhood home was filled with so many of them. After their marriage in 1955, my parents lived in Arizona, where Dad taught English at Arizona State University, then called Arizona State College. Mom, with my big sister Sherry in tow, managed the trailer park where they lived. One hot afternoon, as she and Sherry sat under a tree to cool off, Mom was inspired to write a children's story about an elf named Tandy who was trying to find a home before winter. With the help of all the woodland characters, Tandy was able to do just that. Dad loved the story, and my parents worked on it together. I was 8 when Dad got a new job and we moved to Michigan. Seeing snow for the first time, I felt a little bit like Tandy the elf. In 1971, children's publishing house Platt and Munk Company published their book, A Home for Tandy, illustrated by twins Tim and Greg Hildebrandt. Those artists later illustrated the Star Wars movie posters. I was 12 when I watched my parents smile at patrons of a local bookstore during their first book signing. They wrote many more books for children, and I continue their legacy by sharing my love of reading with others. Now in my 60s, I write and illustrate children's books and volunteer as a reading mentor. There is no greater gift than seeing a child's self-confidence grow when they learn to enjoy the power of words. Russ Mackey submits an article titled, New Models Become the Fashion, for the Classic Car category of the magazine. A much-anticipated event, the annual introduction of new auto models once was welcomed at dealerships with searchlights and balloons, and now with a blitz of media marketing. But the industry didn't start that way. For decades, model designs and engineering improvements occurred incrementally. Ford's Model T, for instance, was essentially the same through its factory run from 1908 to 1927. Credit for annual model changes goes to General Motors Chief Alfred P. Sloan, Jr., who led the move to introduce fashion to auto design. Sloan's marketing strategies helped GM surpass Ford as the dominant automaker in North America. The first GM model to get an aesthetic facelift, but without a significant update in engineering, was the Chevrolet in 1923, the same year Sloan became the company's president. Coach builder and automotive designer Harley Earl caught Sloan's attention when he was commissioned to produce a new design for Cadillac division model, the 1927 LaSalle. Sloan quickly put Earl in charge of design and color for all the brands under the GM umbrella. That same year, Buick began printing each model year prominently on the cover of its promotional brochures. While rival Ford's Model T was produced for nearly two decades, its successor, the Model A, lasted only 5 years. By 1933, Ford also adapted marketing based on model year. Chrysler, Studebaker, Nash, and Hudson followed suit as the decade progressed. Seasonal changes in demand made layoffs common in the auto industry. President Franklin D. Roosevelt ordered on January 31, 1935, that new models of passenger cars can be introduced in the fall instead of the winter to result in a greater regularity of work and in lessening the spread between the peaks and valleys of employment. And did you know that in 1965, the word Bogart was used as slang for bullying and later for monopolizing something, such as cigarettes, inspired by the actor Humphrey Bogart and his style of smoking? Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is for people who are blind and print impaired. Reminisce is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.